Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Mishpatim, the Hebrew Slave. This week's podcast is presented by Rabbi Michael Hatton. Rabbi Hatton is a member of the Pardes faculty. His focus is Tanakh. And now, Rabbi Michael Hatton.
Thank you, Larry. And Mazal Tov. Parshat Mishpatim, the Hebrew Slave. Last week, we read about the revelation at Sinai and God's proclamation of the Decalogue. Just a short few months after the people of Israel had left Egypt, they expectantly gathered at the foot of the thundering mountain to hear God's word. Overawed by the spectacle, they fearfully approached Moshe to communicate God's laws in God's stead, but the prophet demurred. Moshe said to the people, "Do not fear, for the Lord has come in order to test you, and so that the fear of him might be before you always, so that you transgress not." Only afterwards did Moshe then ascend on high in order to receive the remainder of God's laws. Parshat Mishpatim constitutes one of the Torah's most comprehensive treatments of the laws. While it cannot be said to be exhaustive, its variegated legislation relates to every facet of human existence. It delineates the parameters of our relationship with others, their person as well as their property, while not ignoring our relationship with God as well. It discusses laws of indenture, torts, deposits and loans, sexual misdemeanors, as well as treatment of the convert, widow and orphan, presentation of sacrifices, and celebration of the pilgrim festivals. In short, Parshat Mishpatim presents us with the daunting challenge of building a just and kind society, a society in which the responsibilities of the individual towards his neighbor, as well as towards his God, are regarded with equal gravity and fulfilled with matching enthusiasm. And while we tend to lead compartmentalized lives, consciously separating our social connections from our God connection, often compromising one in the service of the other, the sensitive person recognizes that wholeness means integration. The complete and fully developed personality, at least insofar as Jewish tradition is concerned, lives his life in the constancy of God's presence, whether he is engaged in the narrow act of religious devotion and the fulfillment of associated observances and rituals, or whether instead he is occupied by the more mundane pursuits of earning a livelihood and interacting with his employees, his neighbors, his family, or his friends. While much of the subject matter of the Parsha, particularly as it relates to property law and damages, is phrased in anachronistic terms, oxen and donkeys, sheep and cattle, the principles involved are nonetheless still relevant and meaningful. The opening of the Parsha, however, presents us with material that is not only more dated, but morally challenging as well. Slavery. How are we to understand the Torah's seeming condoning of an institution that we rightly regard as a product of a bygone age, abolished, uprooted, and discarded by our modern, democratic, and enlightened societies? This week, we will consider the concept of the Hebrew slave, saving the topic of the Canaanite or non-Jewish slave for a different occasion. In order to gain an appreciation of how the text and the rabbinic interpreters of the text grappled with the matter, transforming in the process an ancient and unjust convention into something much more benign, and unleashing a dynamic that would ultimately consign slavery to the proverbial dustbin. Before we begin, we must ask ourselves a preliminary question. What is it that is so morally repugnant with slavery at all? In the most straightforward sense, we recognize that slavery is wrong for two interrelated reasons. First of all, the imposition of bondage upon another human being is an abrogation of his or her fundamental right to freedom and a frontal attack upon his or her status as a person. As a slave, one is not permitted to make any personal choices. even when these do not necessarily impact directly upon the slave's relationship with his master or else conflict with his will. By definition, a slave is one who is the chattel or property of another, to be bought, sold, or traded like any other commodity. The institution of slavery thus subverts human dignity by indifferently relating to the human being and to his or her labor as nothing more than some sort of a resource to be exploited. Additionally, slavery fosters oppression and cruelty, for it is clearly understood that in order to maintain an individual in its unjust and unnatural throes, intimidation, force, and violence will have to be applied. The acute vulnerability that is the time-honored lot of the slave because of his or her dire situation is often further cultivated by the unscrupulous master with brutal blows. The most pronounced example in our tradition of this sort of slavery and its vicious excesses is, of course, the oppression of the Hebrews in Egypt. Shorn of their human dignity and personal freedoms, subjected like beasts of burden to back-breaking toil and drudgery, and encouraged to churn out their daily tally of mud bricks by the taskmaster's harsh and demeaning shouts and by the sting of his whip, the Hebrews languished mightily until God redeemed them. The people of Israel groaned because of the hard work, and they cried out. And their outcry on account of the hard work ascended heavenward towards the Lord. The Exodus from Egypt was in fact the first recorded instance of human history of a concerned and compassionate God proclaiming in utterly unambiguous terms that serfdom was wrong and that slavery, even in the service of a God-king, must not be tolerated. When we therefore come to consider the Torah's view of this institution and the divine demarcation of its acceptable parameters, we do so against the backdrop of our own experiences in the land of the Pharaohs, and we must continuously ask ourselves whether in fact the slavery referred to in the text of Parshat Mishpatim fits this iniquitous paradigm or not. These are the statutes that you shall place before them. If you purchase a Hebrew slave, then he shall labor for 6 years, but in the seventh he shall go forth to freedom for nothing. If he arrived alone, then he shall go forth alone. But if he had a wife, then his wife shall go forth with him. Shmot chapter 21, verses 1 through 3. Considering the above passage, we are immediately struck, of course, by the fact that the Hebrew slave does not serve his master in perpetuity, but rather for a set duration of 6 years. This time frame is not subject to adjustment. Thus, he and his master both understand that his servitude may not be absolute. Additionally, after this period, the master can exercise no rights over his slave's wife. He cannot hold her hostage, so to speak, at the conclusion of the slave's term of service in order to compel him to extend it. The traditional interpretation, Talmud Bavli Tractate Kiddushin 22a, goes one step further. For it insists that for the whole period that the Hebrew slave labors for his master, not only do his wife and children remain free, but the master is actually obligated to support them financially. Even without this additional and remarkable insistence upon the slave's spousal maintenance, both of these simple provisions are pronounced departures from the conventional forms of bondage practiced in the ancient world at the time. They begin to define an institution that is intended to be more benevolent. While the text does go on to discuss provisions for a lengthier term of service, as well as situations in which the wife of the slave and his children do not go forth in freedom with him, the Torah's fundamental premise that a slave possesses certain inalienable rights remains in place. Our section does not spell out under what circumstances a Hebrew might become a slave in the first place. Our tradition, however, based upon an oblique reference later in the Parsha, as well as a statement in Sefer Devarim, limits the practice to only two situations. Concerning the first of these circumstances, our Parsha goes on to detail other sundry laws that pertain to torts and to damages, and then parenthetically indicates, chapter 22, verse 2, that in the case of theft of property, the apprehended thief must make restitution and pay a fine. If he is unable to pay the principal, then he shall be sold on account of his theft. The rabbis understood that to mean that only a thief who could not repay the theft is to be sold into slavery by the convicting court, so that the funds could be restored to their rightful owner. In other words, this form of slavery is interpreted to be not a callous mistreatment of a vulnerable and poor member of society, but rather an act of restitution for a crime, with the sale to be carried out under the watchful eyes of the judiciary. The second situation is spelled out in Parshat Re'eh. We will quote the passage at length because it contains other material that pertains to our investigation. The text states, "If your Hebrew brother or sister becomes indigent and serves you for 6 years, then in the seventh year you shall send him forth free from you. When you send him forth free from you, then you shall not send him forth empty-handed. You shall surely provide him generously from your sheep, from your threshing floor, and from your winepress. That with which God your Lord has blessed you, you shall give of it to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and God your Lord liberated you. Therefore I command you this day to do this thing." Devarim 15, verses 12 through 15. Here, it is acute poverty that precipitates the sale into slavery, not at the behest of the convicting court, but rather at the initiative of the poor person himself. In this scenario, the utterly destitute person, whose other prospects have been exhausted, could, at last resort, secure a steady source of sustenance by agreeing to serve others for the set period of 6 years, and in the end go forth not only in freedom, but with substance as well. As the rabbis understood it, only one who was so desperate that he possessed not even clothes upon his back could sell himself into servitude, but no other man had the right, not even his rapacious creditors, to initiate that sale. Once again, the slavery that the Torah condones in this situation is more like a form of proto-social welfare for those members of an agrarian economy that had no other means at their meager disposal. How astonishing that at the conclusion of the term of service, the master is commanded to generously provide his freed slave with the products of his toil, so that his return to independence might commence on a more solid footing. We turn now to the nature of the servitude, to the types of activities that the Hebrew slave could not be made to perform. Here, our main passage is from the book of Vayikra, that describes the laws of the sabbatical year and the Jubilee. The text states in chapter 25, verses 39 through 43, "If your brother who is with you becomes indigent and is sold to you, then you shall not make him labor as a slave. He shall rather be like an employee and a dweller with you. He shall serve you no longer than until the Jubilee year. Then he shall go forth from you, he along with his children, to return to his family and to his ancestral estate. For they are my servants. I have taken them forth from the land of Egypt. So they shall not be sold after the manner of slaves. You shall not oppress him harshly, but you shall fear your Lord." Here, the text outlaws maltreating the Hebrew slave, or even relating to him from the outset as a slave. His servitude is to be considered more like employment. His status is to be considered more like that of a paid employee. Considering the definition of the outlawed labor of a slave, the nature of prohibited harsh oppression, the rabbis mention a number of striking examples. "Do not make him labor as a slave. This means that you shall not make him carry your towel after you or your garments before you to the bathhouse. Do not oppress him harshly. This means that you shall not tell him to heat a cup of water when you do not need it, or else to cool a cup when it is unnecessary. Do not say to him, "Dig beneath the grapevine until I return." Sifra Parshat Behar, Chapter 7, Paragraph 2, Section 6, Passage 2. Here the carrying of the towel or the garments to the bathhouse is not forbidden because it is physically demanding, but rather because it is demeaning, for it clearly proclaims to one and to all the lowly status of the bearer. Thus it is to be outlawed. As for harsh oppression, this is understood to mean any sort of activity that the master conjures up simply to keep his slave occupied, heating or cooling the cup, or else the performance of duties, even reasonable ones, that have not clearly been delineated. One cannot ask the slave to perform labors without indicating their extent, such as digging until the master's return, whenever that might be. Once again, the rabbis went beyond the straightforward reading of the text in their desire to restrict slavery's corrosive effects. But their interpretations should not be regarded as unwarranted and fanciful innovations, but rather as the natural and organic extension of the spirit of the Torah legislation as it is expressed in these passages. If the Egyptian experience is our gauge, then identification with the less fortunate among us is our goal. And where there is sincere identification, there cannot be harsh oppression. Perhaps we should leave the last word on the matter to the Talmud, Kiddushin 22a, that comments upon the curious phrase, "your brother that is with you," quoted above, from Vayikra 25, verse 39. The Talmud understands that it is not simply an idiom describing location, but rather a statement of relationship. Your brother that is with you must be treated like yourself. The Talmud relates, "with you" indicates that he shall be equal to you with respect to food and to drink. Do not consume fine bread while giving him coarse bread to eat. Do not drink old wine while giving him new wine to have. Do not sleep upon a soft mattress while providing him with straw to rest upon. Based upon these provisions, it has been said that one who purchases a Hebrew slave has in reality acquired a master for himself. We all, of course, realize that the Torah's noble laws in this respect are one thing, while the actual practices of less noble people were quite probably something else entirely. See, for instance, Yirmiyahu's harsh condemnation of his late First Temple period compatriots concerning the maltreatment of their Hebrew slaves in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 34, verses 8 through 22. But at the same time, we also appreciate that the most powerful engines for social progress are education, identification, and internalization. The institution of slavery as practiced is in much of the world up until the modern era, and still popular in some countries today, provided nothing even remotely as enlightened as the laws of the Hebrew slave. It is no wonder indeed that for most Jews the thoughts of slavery and of its associated injustices are repugnant and vile. That is because our Torah is a teaching of life, and its laws are laws of compassion. And though we may find within its ancient statutes, admittedly revealed at a particular moment in human history, echoes of a seemingly departed era, we also find within those very laws the seeds for the positive transformation of human society. For further study, see the Rambam's coherent and concise formulation of the laws pertaining to the Hebrew slave in his monumental code, Book of Acquisition, Laws of Slaves, Chapters 1 to 3. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Hatton. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.